It's my great pleasure to host today's teleclass. My name's Debbie King and I'm the lead infection control nurse for Solihull Care Trust in the West Midlands. And today's teleclass is presented by Lauren Tew, who's been in ICN since 1992 and always been an active member of ICNA. Between 2000 and 2004, she coordinated the education committee for that association and contributed to both editions of the professional core competencies for practitioners in infection prevention and control. Her interest in reducing catheter-associated urinary tract infections developed in during 2002 when she had the opportunity to represent the ICNA on a joint group with the Thames Valley University and Bard, where they performed a number of regional workshops promoting the implementation of the EPIC guidelines. Latterly, Lauren has been working as a consultant in the medical devices arena. And so, Lauren, if I could ask you to present your teleclass, catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Debbie, and good day to all of you out there listening into this teleclass. I'm very delighted to be doing this. Would you like to move on to the first slide? This is the reference to an article that Debbie, who's just done the introduction and is chairing this teleclass, Ian Pomfret and I put together last year. It was published in the Nursing Standard, a leading journal in the UK, as a continuing professional development article, and as such has activities within it to promote learning. So you will find that during this teleclass, I ask you to stop and pause for thought a couple of times just to get your brains clicking over and help you to learn what we're going through. Virtually all the references that I'm using in this teleclass are cited in this reference, and you'll be able to get the references from Paul if you email him after the teleclass. Next slide. Ooh, one of those catheters. Yes, this device is ubiquitous throughout acute and primary healthcare. It's an absolutely essential device for the saving of lives sometimes and the maintaining of those lives. But unfortunately, it does have inherent risks, and that's the whole point of this teleclass today, to explore some of those risks. Now, Bandelier estimate that you have a 1 in 4 chance of catheterization should you go into hospital. So I think we all need, for our own benefits as well as for our patients' benefits, to know all that we can do about this invasive device. Next slide. Here are some outcomes for this session. We're going to be looking at infection risks associated with catheterization. We're also going to step outside the clinical and look at the professional issues as well, briefly touching on accountability and responsibility. And we'll take a look at the contemporary evidence-based guidelines for preventing catheter-associated urinary tract infections. Now, we could spend an entire teleclass on each one of these bullet points, so this will be quite a whistle-stop tour, and we'll just be providing you signposts to go out and find out some more information. If you turn to the next slide, you'll see one of the inspirations for my interest in catheter-associated urinary tract infections. A hero of mine, Robert Pratt, and his team at Thames Valley University were responsible for producing our first evidence-based guidelines for the prevention of infection in the United Kingdom. These were supported by the Department of Health and covered not only urethral catheters but also several other areas of care. They've been updated in 2004, and the very next edition is due early next year. But our first edition in 2001 had this statement in it, that catheterizing patients places them in significant danger of acquiring a urinary tract infection. We can't really take these urinary catheters too seriously. They are very risky medical devices. Now, when I'm talking during this teleclass of catheter-associated urinary tract infection, I'll be speaking about symptomatic bacteriuria. Now, the definitions of catheter-associated UTI do vary, and when you read different pieces of work, you will soon notice that. And once the definition has been indeed defined, sometimes the application of that definition can be difficult, especially when you're dealing with older people who perhaps have a chronic catheter in situ. Their levels of pyuria, that's pus in the urine, and bacteriuria, bacteria in the urine, can be phenomenal, excuse me, without causing them any apparent symptoms. So this is quite a difficult subject, and I would refer you back to teleclasses. Earlier this year, Dr. Chesley Richard spoke on UTI in urinary tract infection in long-term care. And then the previous year, Dr. Lindsay Nichols spoke on managing UTIs in long-term care. Both of these authors are well worth reading up if you're interested in this subject. And do discuss the difficulty in applying definitions to this older group of patients who sometimes just don't do what we expect them to in the way of symptoms. So let's go to the next slide where we'll look at some background information. Here are some authors that whose work I've read that have come up with some very interesting points. So the prevalence of catheterization in hospitalized patients can vary quite a bit depending on the inpatient group there. Unfortunately, if you look at those hospitalized patients, you will find that some have been catheterized unnecessarily. And Sanjay Saint and his team had a look at some patients in hospital just marking their reason for catheterization against what normally you would expect and found that some really weren't justified. This may be not only the most preventable device-related infection, but the most common nosocomial infection worldwide. Again, demanding our attention here. But if we move to the next slide, we'll see that the risk of catheterization has been known for years. Look at the dates on these two quotations. I'd like to say the first one predates even myself, but sorry, I was around then when Mr. Beeson was writing. And look at that second quotation by Calvin Cunin. It sounds so simple, doesn't it, draining the bladder? But oh dear me, we've got the problem of infection. And even today, the recognition of these risks don't seem to be demonstrated in practice. Now, I've been an infection control nurse since 1992, and I learnt then that you should drain urinary drainage bags into a suitably decontaminated or disposable vessel. I still hear, even to this day, that this is not happening and that dirty old jug in the sluice is being swished around under a running tap and then being taken out to the next patient. That is not decontamination. That will not remove the risk to the subsequent patient of contamination with the previous patient's microorganisms. So these basic things that we would like to hope are taking place still aren't. Moving on to the next slide, a summary about the danger and the morbidity associated with catheters. Some more work here listing some of the complications of catheterization. 3 times the risk of dying, heaven forbid, and then an excess stay in hospital of more than 3 days. And interestingly, if you've got a urinary catheter in situ, the risk of surgical site infection is raised. What about the list of complications provided by Salgado in that last bullet point? I can hardly even say them, let alone imagine how painful they must be. So let's move on again. Another slide entitled A Significant Danger. Even more risks. Thankfully, catheter-associated bacteremia is relatively rare, but many of us listening into this teleclass will be able to recall a patient, or several perhaps, who've been made seriously ill by such an infection. On that last point, Tenke examined catheterized patients who died and found that a third of them, although they had no fever when they died, had evidence of acute pyelonephritis when they were examined at post-mortem. So we can't assume that asymptomatic bacteriuria is harmless. We must be considering how we can avoid it in the first place. Now, before we move on, just pause for a second to think of some reasons for catheterization. And if you turn to the next slide, I'm sure you'll find those reasons that you've considered listed there. And I'd like to thank Ian Pomfret, my friend and co-author of the article I mentioned earlier, for this comprehensive list. We must be able, as professionals, to justify why we put an individual in significant danger of a urinary tract infection. Another anecdote from a nursing friend of mine, her mother unfortunately had a cerebrovascular accident and was wheeled on a trolley into an examination room in an accident and emergency department. This lady had had no assessment by a healthcare professional. She was just being put in the right place to be examined. But alongside her was brought in the catheterisation trolley. So nobody knew whether or not she would need a urinary catheter, but blow me, there was the equipment already, an assumption being made that she certainly would. So if we move on to the next slide and think about assessment, I would like to say immediately that this is not an exhaustive list. I'm not a continence advisor, nor am I a urology nurse specialist. I am an infection control nurse. But here are some of the pointers that must be considered when a urinary catheter is going to be used. At assessment, you've got to make sure you've got the correct device. Its diameter, the charrier, the French gauge, what size of balloon, how long it is. And here in the UK, we have female length and a standard length, which is sometimes miscalled male length. And then there's the composition, is it latex, silicon, or whatever that the device is made of. During the assessment of the patient and their need for the urinary catheter, you also need to consider by which route that catheter will be inserted, be it urethrally, suprapubically, or perhaps an intermittent catheterization. Then the drainage system. Why not use a valve? Let the patient do as much as they can to control the drainage of urine from their bladder. It maintains the bladder tone and keeps carers' hands away, which as an infection control nurse seems to me to be a really good idea, and gives the patient some power over what's going on. Think also of the length of the drainage system and whether or not a link system is needed. But in my experience of discussing with general clinical nurses urinary catheterization, and the selection of the appropriate device for the individual patient, I would suggest that there are some gaps in the knowledge there, and go to your policy folder, go to your intranet in your trust, go to the experts and seek advice if you're not sure what should be going where. There are horror stories that keep coming along of, for example, the male patient being fitted with a female length catheter that is actually too short, is inflated in the urethra and then causes awful trauma to that urethra. So beware, there are complications if you don't undertake this initial assessment very comprehensively. Let's move on to the next slide, where you'll find some words taken from the UK Code of Professional Conduct from our Nursing and Midwifery Council. Those of you listening from elsewhere in the world will have, I'm sure, your own standards in the way of professional conduct. I think as far as urinary catheterization is concerned, perhaps we are focusing on that final bullet point where we need to identify and minimize risks to our patients. So turn to the next slide and just pause for a moment as you read this through. Just consider your professional accountability, and are you always practicing within your code, or could you improve? Difficult questions, but you really need to be thinking about them. Okay, let's move on again, still considering this significant danger to our patients and the need to make sure they have informed consent. That first bullet is taken from the UK's Association for Continence Advice Notes on Good Practice, which are about to be reprinted. They've been updated just now. So look out for those. Our Department of Health has guidelines, of course, also on consent. And Debbie Rigby has done some interesting work on just what patients know about their catheters and how they work, and that very often they really don't. So we need to consider these points when we're asking a patient's consent to perform this invasive procedure. And it's absolutely essential to document exactly all that's been going on and that the patient has given their consent for this procedure. Even when you're changing on a habitual basis, if the catheter is being changed at the end of its life for the next one and there is no alternative, just make sure that it's documented that the patient's given their permission. It doesn't have to be written down. What I mean is the patient doesn't have to sign a written consent form, but you should be documenting that they've given their verbal consent. Now, based on what we've done so far, turn to the next slide and pause again. Think about the information that you give a patient when you catheterize or recatheterize them. And just how much do you document? Are you documenting everything you should, and could this be improved? Let's go on to the next slide now, looking at urinary catheters and the way they cause infection. As I said earlier, they're ubiquitous in healthcare and absolutely essential and save many lives. But in doing that, they do make several problems. And one of the ways they do cause problems is because they breach our body's own defenses, our body's excellent defenses at keeping microorganisms, etc., at bay. Every bit of physiology you can think of is working to keep bugs at bay in our bodies, all going on normally without us even knowing about it. It's absolutely miraculous. But unfortunately, the bugs are very clever, and we'll go on in a minute to say a bit more about biofilms because of their importance in catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Now, some of the bugs are so clever that they can produce enzymes such as urease, which will break down certain components in the urine, change the acid-alkali balance in the urine, and lead to a cascade of events, which eventually ends up in encrustation, which I'm sure must feel as horrible as it sounds. And unfortunately, that may lead to catheter blockage occurring. And of course, that doesn't happen Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, when all the facilities are available. So many patients have their nights and their weekends disturbed and end up desperately distressed by catheter blockage. And of course, systemic infection may develop also. So we're going to turn on now to the next slide and look at a bit more in detail about the real culprits in the crime of catheter-associated urinary tract infections. The real villains are biofilms. And I'd recommend a really good paper by Trautner and Darowish on this, where they suggest that the influence of biofilms extends to diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Now, microorganisms are all very, very careful. They might be tiny and basic organisms, but my goodness me, they aren't half clever. All they want to do is stay on this planet and multiply. And the mechanism of a biofilm helps them do that. It's just a survival instinct. It makes them resistant to shear forces, to the effect of our white cells in phagocytosis, and to antimicrobial agents. In some biofilms, you'll have a group of some slow-growing, some faster-growing, different species of microorganisms, but it all allows for resistance to transfer from one species to another. This is the last thing we need, another route by which microorganisms can become resistant to antibiotics. And biofilms are found not only on the catheters themselves and on the drainage systems, the plastics or whatever that are used in the devices, but also on our very own bodily tissues, for example, the uroepithelium. If we turn to the next slide, here's a little bit about biofilms and microbial resistance, antimicrobial resistance. Lieb et al. Suggested that a huge proportion of antibiotic prescriptions for urinary tract infection are inappropriate. And surprise, surprise, as a result of that, we've got increased resistance to antibiotics in chronic catheterized patients, up to 14% carrying microbial species that are resistant. And of course, Professor Getliff's work back in the 90s demonstrated that approximately 50% of patients with long-term catheters will end up with problems of blockage, a real disaster for them. The next slide is a little schematic of biofilm formation. Just to demonstrate how important biofilms must be, there is a Center for Biofilm Engineering, and I would refer you to the excellent website that Montana State University has for this department. This little picture just shows in the initial side there on the left, the conditioning film that settles on the surface of any invasive device, be it a urinary catheter, be it a heart valve, be it a central venous catheter that's been inserted into a human. A conditioning film, certainly in urinary catheters, it'll be urinary proteins and some cells. In a central venous catheter, it might be some fibrin and products from the blood that settle on the surface. But as soon as that's settled, the microorganisms start thinking, yippee, let's settle down on here. Some will continue floating in their planktonic form in the bulk fluid. Some will colonize that surface and grow into very nice high-rise, des res communities, as you'll see in the next slide, again from the Center for Biofilm Engineering. So you'll see the surface structure there is the gray hash marks. Then you've got the conditioning film, and then you've got these blobs of biofilm. Now, some biofilms are much deeper than others. Some will be several stories high, if you like. Others will be a single layer. The bulk fluid, be it urine in our case, or perhaps blood in a CVC, can flow through the gaps within the biofilm, providing nutrients for the bacteria. And you can see there are streamers there, which particularly in central venous catheters could detach and take that blood, take that infection in the bloodstream to another site. So there are high-rise, des res, gated community, gated because they keep the antimicrobials out. And it's been estimated that the bacteria within a biofilm can be 100 to 1,000 times more resistant to antimicrobials than those that are free-floating. So they're very, very clever. And how fast do these microorganisms multiply? Turn to the next slide and you'll see. Here we have pictures of good old Pseudomonas aeruginosa at 2 hours and then at 18 hours on a silicon Foley catheter. My goodness me, look at the masses in that right-hand picture. Now, when I'm teaching, I use this slide, and I ask what that right-hand picture suggests to the audience. Virtually every time I ask that question, I get the same answer, and that is maggots. And I hope some of you are squirming, and I hope some of you will remember that picture when you're providing care to patients with catheters and be extra fastidious about your hand hygiene and your aseptic management of that part of the patient's equipment. Let's turn on to the next slide. This is a nice little picture of a Celtic brooch from sort of western sides of the UK. But actually, it's not the brooch I want you to look at. It symbolizes four key things that lead to blockage of urinary catheters. So it's the biography of blockage, all beginning with B. So here we have bacteria. In the first place, let's keep them out by aseptic technique when the catheter's inserted and by fastidious management of the catheter, keep them out as far as we possibly can, thus reducing bacteriuria and hopefully reducing the amount of biofilm that develops. Although to a certain degree, some of this will be inevitable when an invasive device is inserted into the urethra. But if we do what we can to keep these three Bs out of the way, then hopefully the risk of blockage will be minimized and we'll have done all we can to ensure our patients' comfort. Another picture here. Now, I wonder if any of you can guess which microorganism this is. I have to say I first chose this picture as wallpaper for my laptop because I like the turquoise and brown colours. Very contemporary, aren't they? But actually, it's a real beastie. And this is a microorganism that's much related to problems with long-term catheters. It's Proteus mirabilis. And this is a gram-negative rod that can produce urease and cause precipitation of crystals from urine, and hence form blockage. The next slide is a biofilm. And interestingly, there is no relationship between the longevity of a catheter and the thickness of the biofilm. I only learnt this recently, and I had previously assumed that the longer a catheter was in place, the thicker its biofilm would be, but this is not necessarily the case. Some biofilms will be thin and patchy, others will be thick and cover the entire surface, and most will be composed of four or more different types of bacteria. Interestingly, when sampling catheters and the urine from those catheters, Ganderton et al. Found that bacteriuria is actually less common than biofilm. So virtually all the catheters that they investigated had biofilm on it, but that microorganism wasn't always showing up in the patient's urine. Now, some of you, I'm sure, will want to cross your legs when you look at the next picture. This is an encrusted catheter on a slide entitled Blockage. Now, I can't imagine how sore that must have been when it was removed. I don't think there's an awful lot more that I need to say about that picture. It speaks for itself, doesn't it? But anything that we can do to reduce that happening, I think, will be much to our patient's benefit. Now, can you think of any risk factors for catheter-associated urinary tract infection? On the next slide, you'll find some of these risk factors, and I've put together some work by Salgado and Tambaya here to produce this list. And I'm sure some of you will recognize these things. There's no point in going through every single one of them individually. I'm sure that you won't be surprised with them. I will say a bit more about drainage tube above the bladder in a moment or two, having said that. But many of those in our care will have several of these risk factors. Just pause now and think about someone with a catheter whom you've cared for. And looking at the next slide, identify in your mind the risk factors that that patient had for catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Was there any alternative management that could have prevented the need for the patient to be catheterized? Difficult questions, aren't they? We know that catheters are always going to be needed. We need to acknowledge the risks and take steps to be proactive about reducing those risks. What can we do about the risks? Well, turn to the next slide. And one thing that we can do is to implement evidence-based guidelines. Now, I've already mentioned our first guidelines in the UK, the EPIC guidelines, and you can take that to mean either guidelines that are evidence-based practice in infection control, or the fact that the project was of epic proportions. I think both definitions are true for these. In our article, Ian, Debbie and I summarised these evidence-based guidelines and we've put them together. Again, we could do a whole teleclass on just these guidelines, but we will run through them quickly while we're here as part of this presentation now. Some of this stuff we'll be repeating, but it actually never does any harm to hear things more than once. So the first point there, is the catheter absolutely necessary? Are you absolutely sure you have to use that catheter? Make sure you're completely sure about this. If you are going to put a catheter in, make sure that you make plans to review the necessity of that catheter and document that you will be doing so. When you review the catheter, remove it if you possibly can at the earliest possible occasion. When you're assessing what sort of catheter to use, and we've covered a little bit of this, think about how long it's going to be in there. Think about what your clinical experience has taught you about the different types of catheters. Think about the patient's preference, because certainly if you are changing a catheter for somebody who's been catheterized in the long term, they may well know what they like and what they do not like. And also think about the infection risk. Now, I'll just tuck in here something that those of you who aren't in the UK or Europe might not realise. In the UK and Europe, we have two different licences for urinary catheters, which makes them either of a 28-day duration or 12-week duration. Depending on which licence they have to be removed at that time, either at 28 days or at 12 weeks. Otherwise, the liability for the correct functioning of that device lands firmly on the practitioner's shoulders, the individual who has decided to leave that catheter longer than the manufacturers recommend. I know that in some other areas of the world, the catheter stays in until it stops working, and patients aren't subjected to recatheterization and the trauma that that causes every 28 days or 12 weeks. So we are a bit different over here when it comes to duration of individual catheterization, individual catheters. Always consider intermittent self-catheterization. Now, this, of course, depends on your assessment of the patient's mental and manual dexterity. Maybe there's a carer who could intermittently catheterize this patient. That will involve a lot of education, of course, but again, it could be a possibility. There is some evidence, but it's not overwhelming, that intermittent self-catheterization is associated with a lower risk of infection, so that will certainly be worth considering. As I've mentioned earlier, consider using a valve so that the bladder tone is maintained and so that the urine's not dripping down a urinary drainage tube into a bag all the time, but can be voided when the patient feels the need down into a toilet. It's rather more normal that way, isn't it? And it may be very, very suitable for some patients, not for others. I would like to see the use of valves being championed in acute care rather more than it is, because I'm sure from my experience in acute care, there are patients in those beds who could be looking after their own catheter and its emptying rather than having a drainage bag on and then needing to retrain their bladder for a while before they can be comfortably voiding normally again. Use a catheter of the smallest gauge so that the urethra, which is normally closed, it's been described to me as like a particular ice cream dessert. I don't know if you've got them elsewhere. We over here have them called Viennetta, and it's all sort of folded. Well, that's how the urethra is when it's not catheterized. You might want to consider it as an Arctic roll once it's got a catheter in it, and I'm really sorry if I've put anybody off ice cream there. But a catheter artificially dilates the delicate mucous membrane of the urethra, and if that catheter is too large, it will be bruising and potentially causing necrosis of the delicate urethral mucosa for the duration of its insertion. Always use the smallest balloon, 10 mils for an adult, unless, of course, this is a postoperative balloon when a 30 mil capacity is necessary, and children, of course, need a much smaller balloon. Please, even when you're catheterizing ladies, do use a lubricant. Just because we females have a smaller, a shorter urethra doesn't mean to say that we don't need lubricant to facilitate the passage of an invasive device up into our bladder. And this should be a single-use container that's discarded once it's been opened. Now, as I said earlier, I am an infection control nurse, and no infection control nurse can speak for long without talking about hand decontamination. Looking at the clock, I've been going for 35 minutes before mentioning it, and that must be a record. You cannot overemphasize the importance of hand decontamination as a method of reducing the risk of transmission of microorganisms from one patient to another, from the healthcare provider to the patient, etc. We nowadays have much easier hand decontamination than we ever used to with the arrival of alcohol hand rubs and gels. It really does mean that you can have point of use facilities for hand decontamination. And going on to the next topic, use of gloves. Hands must be decontaminated before and after each use of gloves. Gloves need to be changed sometimes whilst you're caring for the same patient, depending on what job you've just done and what job you're just about to do. Sometimes you have to step out and think about what you're doing and realize that you need to change those gloves. So that's a really important message, hand decontamination between every patient contact and before every patient contact, and the use of gloves appropriately for one job and for one job only. Now, you may think that competent aseptic insertion doesn't really need to be there because surely we're all professionals and that's how we'd all do it. Well, I'm sorry. My experience certainly shows that this doesn't always happen. And I can think of a student nurse who, in a distressed state, went to see her infection control team. She'd been working in accident emergency, and this is only very recently. She'd been working in accident and emergency. A patient needed catheterizing. She had laid up the trolley and went with the competent, so say, professional to the patient's bedside with the trolley. Something was missing from the trolley, so off she went to find it. And when she came back, the patient was catheterized, but the trolley that she had prepared so fastidiously was completely untouched, and certainly the sterile field and the dressing pack for the procedure hadn't been opened. Well, there's no excuses for that. We can always do an aseptic technique, provided we have been properly educated and are competent to do that. And we as professionals must make sure that not only are we, but those to whom we delegate this role are competent and able to do that. And once the catheter's in, it must be managed appropriately as well, with, as I've mentioned above, appropriate hand hygiene and use of gloves and other protective equipment as it's necessary. The final point on this slide is to emphasize the need to maintain the closed system. Nowadays, we don't have red rubber catheters draining over the side of the bed into a bucket, but we do still have to maintain the closed system. Every time a urinary catheter is disconnected from its urinary drainage system, there is an opportunity for microorganisms to enter the system, to colonize the system, and to cause a urinary tract infection. Do not undo that link between the catheter and its drainage system unless you have a very good reason for doing so. Okay, these guidelines are continued on the next slide. And you'll see here reference to the original guidelines in 2001 and their update in 2004. And then the National Institute for Clinical Excellence published in 2003 guidelines more specifically for primary care and patients being cared for in the community. So these three documents together have been summarized in this brief outline of the evidence-based guidelines. So the first one here is aseptic samples. If you need to take a sample of urine for analysis by the laboratory, do take it aseptically so that you're not introducing any microorganisms into the system. Do make sure that when you're writing the microbiology request form, you put all the possible information you can think of that could help the lab turn the result of that urine specimen into something really useful, not only for the clinicians involved, but for that patient as the end result. And make sure that whatever goes inside the specimen pot doesn't contaminate the outside of the specimen pot also. The laboratories need as much information as you can give so that they know if this patient has recently had antibiotics, they know how long the catheter has been in situ, they know whether the patient is catheterized for the short term or for the long term and is chronically catheterized. They need to know any symptoms that you feel are indicative of urinary tract infection and perhaps might have been the initiative that you used to take this specimen. I've also read that if you have a patient who is symptomatic with symptoms of a urinary tract infection and you want to take a sample, that it actually will be beneficial and the patient will become afebrile sooner if you remove the old catheter with all its biofilm, insert a brand new catheter, and then take the fresh specimen of urine. That way you'll find out exactly which bug is in that urine rather than what's on the biofilm. Now again, maintain the bladder, the urinary drainage bag below the bladder, and I'll say a bit more about that later. When it comes to maital hygiene, the patient needs to have their usual pattern of hygiene for their private parts. This doesn't have to be some horrible smelly toxic disinfectant or antiseptic, but ordinary soap and water, the patient's preference for their hygiene in that area of their body needs to be carried out. make sure that the patient's individual catheter care regime is documented so that anybody coming along after you knows exactly what that patient's care is, and make sure that you are planning perhaps in a patient who is blocking regularly to change that catheter before the blockage actually occurs. Be proactive and rather than crisis managing. Instillations do not prevent infection and should not be used for that purpose. They may have a use within the catheter itself, dissolving some crystals perhaps, but they will not do anything to prevent infection. And as I emphasized earlier, breaking the link between the catheter and its drainage system could indeed be providing a way in for catheter-associated urinary tract infection microorganisms. So if an instillation is used, it must be done aseptically. I'll say a bit more about silver alloy catheters later also, but do consider these as another way of preventing infection in our patients who need catheters. Training and support is an absolute must-have for the patient themselves and for carers, as we saw in Debbie Rigby's work. And I've put here avoid antibiotic prophylaxis wherever possible. It's the easiest way of developing resistance to these antibiotics. There are some cases where it is essential, and these should be discussed with the patient's medical practitioner and with the local microbiologist, but shouldn't be done just as a matter of routine. Do take care when considering antibiotic prophylaxis with long-term catheterized patients. So those are the guidelines. What else can we do? And you'll see in the next slide that Sanjay Saint has come up with a list of things. This is in one of his pieces of work in 2002. Sanjay Saint and various authors have written quite an array of work on not only urinary catheters but other invasive devices. And Sanjay Saint comes to infection prevention and control as a patient safety perspective and sees it as a way of reducing risks to patients. So here are his suggestions: that we should have adequately educated healthcare staff. Well, wouldn't we all say hear, hear to that? That staff had a good awareness of what alternatives are available, be it condom catheters, be it female urinals, or whatever method can be used to reduce the prevalence of catheterization. Use audit to check up, as he did in one of his earlier studies, whether catheterization is absolutely appropriate. Make sure that you've got some way there to get the catheters out, if possible. And Sanjay's done some work looking at what happens, or how can you go about getting catheters removed. How about a paper reminder to doctors or an electronic reminder? And these methods do seem to help get those catheters out earlier. And, of course, that will reduce our rate of catheter-associated urinary tract infection. Strategies to reduce inappropriate use of catheters must also be employed, and these things will all help us reduce the risk. But the risk is there. We have our guidelines. We have these strategies that Sanjay has suggested, and we also have technology. And maybe now we're beginning to get to the state where we need to look at these devices that are inherently infection prevention devices more thoroughly. And here's a quotation from Dr. Weinstein from Emerging Infectious Diseases. Given the choice of changing human behavior or designing a better device, the device will always be more successful. There's food for thought. Now, that's Dr. Weinstein's perspective, and I'm coming up now with a slide, compliance versus technology, that's taken from a study done by Dennis Mackey, who's well known for his work on the infection risks of invasive devices and again has studied central venous lines and urinary catheters and other devices as well. So just read this quotation from his work. So we need to look at the importance of novel technology. We are maybe at a point of diminishing returns, trying to change people's practice. Oh dear. This is quite interesting, isn't it now? So what did Dr. Mackey and his team do? They looked at 850 newly catheterized patients in a big tertiary care hospital in the States, and they sought out their symptoms of catheter-associated urinary tract infection by prospectively studying these patients. And they found these were the independent predictors for increased risk of catheter-associated urinary tract infection. And again, I'm sure you'll be familiar with these and will recognize them. So we've got extended catheterization, anything more than 6 days increases the risk. Female gender, oops, well, there's not much we women can do about that one. The presence of an invasive device such as the urological stent. Other active infections always increase the risk of more infections, don't they? Malnutrition and the body not having the building blocks to fight off infection. Insulin requiring diabetes, which upsets many of the body's physiological systems. And again, that drainage tube position. This is very similar to the list we looked at earlier. Now, when Dr. Mackey and his team studied these patients and the risk factors, if you turn to the next slide, you'll see that the only catheter care violation predictive of increasing the risk of catheter-associated urinary tract infection was having the drainage tube above the bladder or sagging below the level of the collection bag. So risking and siphoning back and fluid, although there are one-way valves, don't forget there'll be no barrier to a microorganism, or having a dependent loop in the drainage tube sagging below the level of the collection bag. And Dr. Mackey and his team had trained research nurses going around checking out the patient's catheter care and looking at them very carefully to see what was happening. So is it time now, I would suggest, to be seeking help from the devices themselves? We have independent support here in this side of the pond for silver alloy-coated Foley catheters. The evidence-based guidelines I mentioned earlier in their update mentioned the silver alloy-coated catheters and the reduced risk of symptomatic bacteriuria. In the UK, we have a rapid review panel that was first mentioned in 2003 in a paper called Winning Ways by the Chief Medical Officer. In 2004, it started its work and is publishing now reports on new mechanisms, products, procedures, and devices that are claiming to help with the reduction of healthcare-associated infection. And these products are submitted to the Health Protection Agency's Rapid Review Panel and are scrutinized for their efficacy. Now, the silver alloy-coated Foley catheters got the top-level recommendation from this rapid review panel. Other things haven't, and they look at a whole range of things from hand hygiene products to cleaning products to various natural products such as derivatives of certain types of nuts as to whether they have any efficacy. And they feed back to the manufacturers or providers of these gizmos as to whether enough research has been done or not and how relevant these products are. But it's a quick access mechanism to get new things in quickly. So the silver alloy coated Foley catheters got the top level recommendation from that esteemed body of microbiologists, epidemiologists and experts in the field. And in 2004, the Cochrane Collaborative, who do systematic reviews of randomized controlled trials, they looked at the evidence of silver alloy-coated catheters and concluded that not only do they reduce the risk of asymptomatic bacteriuria in patients catheterized under a week, but in those patients catheterized for over a week, hospitalized patients, the risk of symptomatic bacteriuria is also reduced. So we need to consider these expert independent options very carefully and consider their relevance to our patients. Now, being able to be aware of our patients' risk factors and by using our evidence-based guidelines, monitoring that we're following them through audit processes, for example, and by taking advantage of new technology, we will be able to improve the lot of the millions of patients in healthcare who are subjected to indwelling catheterization. So would you like to just turn to the next slide? Because here's just a reminder for you to make the most of this fantastic opportunity that the teleclasses provide. They really are a string to your bow when it comes to continuing professional development. when you leave this class, make the most of it for that development for you as an individual. And this is where our in the UK, the Nursing and Midwifery Council, this is how they recommend that you start to make the most of learning opportunities. Describe the activity. Tease out what your key learning points are and how it's going to affect the way you work. If you do that at the earliest opportunity you have within the next few days, you will be actively learning far more than you realize from these slides. Go over them again and think about how it's going to contribute to your professional work. So that's all I'd like to say. I'm absolutely astonished that I finished a little early. I thought I was going to be squeezing it in a lot tighter, but maybe I have rushed a little. So there's now room for some questions if any of you have any for me.
Thank you, Lauren. If I can just take an opportunity to, first of all, congratulate Lauren on an excellent talk, but also probably being one of the first infection control nurses to go 35 minutes without mentioning hand washing. So well done to you, Lauren.
I'm not going to be hounded out of the Infection Control Nurses Association, am I?
I don't think so, but a record on the making, I do think.
We're quite interested in some of the statistics about the differences that the silver alloy coated catheters have made. You mentioned some of the Cochrane reviews and looking at the randomised control trials. Can you give us any sort of idea of the kind of difference it made to the bacteriuria?
Yes, there's quite a range of studies now, and the results in the reduction in catheter-associated urinary tract infections can be anything from a third up to two-thirds.
Right.
Some of them are really quite impressive. Some small-scale studies in the UK have been published, and one of those in about 150 patients, say, had a reduction of 33%. Another one with about the same number of patients had 70-odd percent. So it's quite impressive, yes.
You referred to poor practice, and I'm sure that a lot of infection control nurses listening today will have got their own horror stories about what they've witnessed or seen. I just wondered whether you had any comments to make about improving practice at sort of coalface level since the publication of the Saving Lives document and the Essential Steps documents in this country.
Yes, I think both of those documents are excellent because they remind practitioners to be looking at what they are actually doing. We know 30 years ago when I started in nursing, we knew that nurses don't do what they say they do. The only way to find out what nurses do is to watch what they are actually doing. And perhaps by getting nurses to think about what they're doing in these initiatives, we can take some steps forward. Maintaining enhanced compliance with guidelines is, again, a really difficult thing and demands the most creative approach from infection control practitioners and from the clinical nurses themselves. We need to be coming up with attractive reminders that will just jog those memories and get people practicing appropriately. We have an increasing number of graduates in the nursing profession nowadays, so we have no excuses when it comes to seeking out the appropriate evidence. We have well-educated people who can go out there and find the evidence and know what they should be doing. So let's give them all the help we can to get out there doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Hear, hear. I'm sure we all echo those sentiments.
Yeah.
And just as one final wish before I say farewell, I'd just like to take this opportunity on behalf of all the organisers of the British Teleclass series, that's Lauren Chu, myself and Maria Benalik, and also Paul Webber, to wish all our American colleagues a happy Thanksgiving for Thursday. And with that, I will leave you and hope to see you all again at the next Teleclass. Bye-bye.